danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 299 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm Andrew Brokus, and I'm very excited to be sitting in the same room as Burke Brown. Hi, Burke.
Hi, Andrew. Good to be here. Also from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Yes.
Burke Brown. Happy to be here in person.
So this is Burke's second appearance on the show. I imagine a fair number of people listened to his first appearance, but if you didn't, I would definitely encourage you to check it out. It was a popular episode. And Burke, your guy has been around poker for a long time, been around Las Vegas poker specifically for a long time as dealer, floor person, player. Am I leaving anything out? Have you served drinks or anything?
I have not served drinks. I actually ran a room up in Seattle back in the day.
That's right.
I've been in Vegas since 07, and I've been in the industry since about 97 or 98 in some small card rooms up in the Portland and Seattle area, both in the state of Washington, but actually ran a 12-table room up there. But since I've been in Vegas, helped run some tournaments when RA opened for a few months, but mostly dealing part-time and playing three-quarters to full-time since 2013.
And I mean, we kind of told the story of how you went through those things in the first episode, but after that episode was over, you came to me and said, you know, there's a couple interesting things that we didn't get to in that first interview, because I think immediately mentioned the possibility of a second since we enjoyed talking to you so much. And I kind of want to jump into a few of the most titillating ones that I think, you know, I want to make sure we get to these this time around. So one of the things that you mentioned was dealing in, you know, some really high stakes games. Like, what did you say? 10, 20, 50, no limit? Or no, it was bigger than that. 25, 50, 100, no limit, I think.
I think it's 51, but unlimited straddles from anywhere. So you're often actually getting like $200 or $400 straddles or $1,000 or $2,000 straddles from anywhere. These guys are just, they kind of want to just fire. But so nominally a 5,100 game, but guys are winning or losing $500,000 in a night, $1 million plus for the week. Mm-hmm. And like the min buy might be 50,000, and you might have eight guys starting out with 50,000. And once they kind of get
right, everybody's got a couple hundred out there.
Yeah, you've got guys playing like, you know, $300,000 to $400,000 pots pretty frequently. I've dealt a bigger game at Aria, which was 2K, 5K, 10K no limit. Back in the day when the Macau guys were in town in the summer.
Ooh, and that's a big game.
Yeah, like that's the biggest game, no limit game that I've dealt. And literally like stacks, and the chairman had a rack of gray 100K chips next to his working stack, you know, like a $15 to $20 million stack. And it was going in. There are a couple of the kids, I'm assuming they were sons of the guys, like they played a 3-bet, 4-bet, 5-bet jam. They were short stacked or whatever. And 500K tank full, and the guy just shows him a five. Like, just, so they're having fun like we were at the 1-3 game. It was just different numbers on the chips. But so that's probably the biggest game I've dealt. But this game, for one that I deal semi-regularly, gets pretty big. It's guys that like their privacy. It's not necessarily mostly people you haven't heard of, one or two that you would know from the Vegas scene. But what happened was, years ago in Dominican Republic, I was dealing a tournament. I'm dealing a PLO cash game, and
Let me pause you there for a second. So was that part of like a tour or something?
Oh,
or
sorry.
How were you dealing in the DR?
Back in the day, I used to deal a couple events a year. We would do, I think the first event I ever traveled for was the Party Poker Millions cruise ship out of San Diego when I was still living in Seattle. And so we dealt that. It's so long ago that it was the 10K main event was still limit. I think it was the last year it was a limit event. So that was my first taste of going on the road to do it. Just some friends of mine from Seattle recommended it. And then we ended up getting hired to do Aruba, and working for Susie Letter out there. So we did the Ultimate Bet Aruba Classic there 3 or 4 years in a row. And she was the tournament coordinator. when they had that one-off event in Turks and Caicos.
I remember that.
She ran that. She brought us there, and Matt Savage took over in Aruba because she thought this was going to be an ongoing thing, and it was such a debacle that it didn't happen anymore. But so events like that, and PCA I've done once. But so Aruba, Turks and Caicos, Dominican Republic, that was, the DR was, funny enough, I think this was a, I think it was a Canadian poker championship where they flew people out for the event, and they had some side events. But a friend of mine, just, it was before Aria opened, so I was still part-time at Bellagio and had a lot of flexibility. So we worked for Susie once in Biloxi, and this Dominican Republic thing came up. They generally pay for airfare and hotel, so,
so you get
everything's paid for. If you, if they need you to work a bunch, come home with some money. If they don't, you get to play a lot, and you're kind of, yeah, exactly, like semi vacation. So that's how that all started. I'm dealing with PLO cash game in Dominican, and have always been pretty quick, or the quickest in the room. And it happened to be PLO, and guy would be like pot, and I'm like 1950, and the guy would be like pot, and I'm like 22,100 or whatever. And we don't, even at Hold'em, we don't often get that. And I don't know if you play much Omaha, so the dealer, you don't often get to know if the dealer knows how much is in the pot, because they're not allowed to tell you or required to tell you. But of my limited list of skills, math is probably near the top. And I pride myself on having that number ready, even though I do it in my head a different way than a lot of people do. Anyway, suffice to say, one of the guys playing in the game and working, was helping to run that tournament, is one of the guys who helps run this private cash game. So to loop back to that, so 4 or 5 years ago, he came up and said, hey, I've got this big cash game. We need a fast dealer who knows what's going on. It's half Omaha, half Hold'em. Need somebody who knows their shit, but also who can deal really, really fast. Like, these guys want to see as many hands as they can. And they want no mistakes. So, he knew that I was playing full-time and I'd quit. Said, I don't know. I never have a lot of notice, but I'll know next week, and we'd be leaving a couple days later. But like, somebody like you would be, are you interested? And I said, sure, I don't need any notice, whatever, I'm flexible. So ended up, our first trip was in the Bahamas. So they fly me out, fly the guys out. They rent like some villas.
So these are like guys from all over the world who sort of like pick a spot to meet up and play a super high-stakes poker game.
Exactly. So they get together a couple times a year, generally for a week or two, and they're rich, so it's generally in a nice location. You know, we're renting these like multi-million dollar villas in the Bahamas and putting them up and like buying a table and shipping it in and getting it set up and just buying like 20 office chairs, you know, like...
And who's the we here? Is that something you can say? Like when you say we're renting villas, we're getting...
Sorry, the people running the game, and it's not even a we. Like, I'm actually just an employee. They pay for my plane tickets. Mm-hmm. They pay for my rooms or Airbnbs or whatever.
They're just like sort of poker industry people who are one-off hired by...
It's a couple guys who run a game, a regular game like in Florida, and got to know some of these guys. And so they kind of put together a game to have a game to play in. And then often one or two guys who aren't playing who are there for support to either like help with all the paperwork, help, it's all based on credit. We're not traveling with all this cash. So taking care of the paperwork, taking care of the chips, getting everything set up, all of that, and dealing. But when the game started to run around the clock, the guy that was doing all of this stuff decided he needed a second body. And asked me if I would be that second body. So I mostly just go and deal and help out a little bit on the side. But yeah, they do a round of each. The game gets pretty absurd. They typically kick the blinds up a couple hours in. They typically kick it up a couple again, mandatory straddle. Then they get bored and they get rid of the hold'em. And now like we're playing 300, 600 PLO. Guys have their nose open. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. So Bahamas was the first one. St. Petersburg. Monte Carlo, and last summer actually I didn't get to play in the main event because about a week beforehand my friend came up and said, hey, I think we're doing the Ukraine. I know you want to play the main, but would you be interested in this? And I'm like, sure, it's variance free money. And they pay for everything. They pay for the airfare, they pay for the room, they pay for the food while we're there. So it's a stone free rule, and the smallest chip on the table is green quarters. So the tips are pretty good. You're not, it's as opposed to blue, right? It's right, not like they're tipping you 25 a hen. Like I'm not making thousands of dollars a day, but.
Yeah, but you don't need to get too many of those to add up to more than.
Yeah, like one of my favorite things is they actually have a thing, if they want a rabbit hunt, they have to give you a quarter. And to make sure that we collect it, they charge us $1,000 if we don't ask for the quarter, just to like incentivize us to not like let one slide because he's stuck or whatever.
Yeah.
Just to make it crystal clear that these guys don't get free roll. So that a guy will like tank fold the river and like fling a quarter at you and you're like, oh, okay, here's the river. Here's a turning river. So that's always fun. Like literally like $200 or $300 a day just because people are curious. Which
that's awesome.
Rich guy, rabbit hunt free roll. So yeah, but the money turns out to be more than I make at home and variance free. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a busman's holiday. Like I didn't enjoy dealing when I was dealing 5 days a week, but I really enjoy it. Or I enjoy it in bits and pieces, fits and spurts. Like if I'm dealing it once or twice a year, it's not bad at all. And the money's good and it's a nice change of pace. And I don't ever get stuck. Never stuck 3,000 in the game. So
I can imagine a lot of reasons why this would be more stressful than typical dealing, but I can also imagine some reasons why it might not be. Like if these are mostly guys on vacation and the money is not, I mean, it's obviously huge money, but like maybe it's to them not that much more significant than what, you know, $300 is to a 1-3 player. I don't know. Is it more or less stressful in different ways?
Yeah, it's funny. Relatively speaking, the money is the same as guys in a 2-5 game. Mm-hmm. That some can really afford it and some not so much, or some of the guys who react the most if I'm playing 2-5 or 5-10 to losing a small to medium pot are the guys who can most afford it, but they still flip out and it's just a competitive thing. So these guys, some are it's like a regular lineup. Some of them get overly worked up about small variants. Some are really cool no matter what, and treat it as if they can afford it. And like some of the nicest guys I've met, but some of the biggest overreactions too. Like I do get treated worse, but they compensate me enough to deal with it. And the guy told me ahead of time, like, look, there's a couple of these guys, just get out of line. But it's their game. Like you're not at RE or whatever, so we're not holding them to the same standards. And they're cool afterwards, like, hey, let me buy a drink, let me get you a massage, whatever. Yeah. But in the heat of the moment, like, they're just competitive. And I think that's one of the reasons they're willing to fly people in and fly around the world to sit for a week, because they just want to battle, you know, bash each other's brains in. So when they're losing, they feel like they're getting their brains bashed in. But generally, like, super nice guys. But, yeah, less stressful because it's not my money and I'm not playing. So it's nice to have a week or two off from my regular job, and more stressful in ways that, because these guys could buy and sell me, and they're just, they get pretty worked up about it. So it's both, but it's generally a pretty good environment. They're having a good time. Like they're getting together for enjoyment. For the most part, I really enjoy it. And every once in a while, I wish I wasn't there. Like I'm really glad when I have a break to go back to my room and chill for a while and let the steam come down. Sometimes they'll just yell for another dealer because the guy lost 2 pots in a row or something.
Right, you're just unlucky.
It's kind of a nice break for everybody. Yeah. Exactly.
And what you didn't mention, and maybe this is just like not on your radar because you don't make mistakes, but I mean, I'd be afraid of making a mistake in a $1 million pot. Like
I do, actually. Stressful, not stressful. I was going to say, like, I don't know a dealer who doesn't make mistakes. Just some of us are faster and make less of them. Just like a good typist, I guess. But I do remember, and we still joke about it. Yeah, it's only 20,000 euros. I'm counting down a pot, and it's an all-in, and the guy's getting counted out to double up and break it down, and 187.5. And the guy's like, how much? And I'm like, 187. And I'm pointing at it and showing him broken down. And so if the loser pays off the 187, and the winner's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, 187, I'm paying you off. What? And he goes, this is 207. And I'm like, oh man. And now I see like another stack or something, of, you know, stack of 1Ks or whatever the mistake was. I see it now and it's very clear to me that it's 207. Sorry, sir, I need another 20,000. It's 207. He's like, yeah, I mean, it's only 20,000 euros. No big deal. But so I'm thinking, well, this is more than I'm going to make this month, right? And it may or may not be a big deal to him, but like it's, yeah, I flushed. It's pretty embarrassing. But they generally take it pretty well. But he was already losing and he was pretty upset about it, but he was fine an hour later. But yeah, it can be stressful.
Yeah.
I feel the same way when dealer doesn't break down a stack and I'm in a red chip game or an orange chip game, and it's guy slides out a stack of orange at Ari in a 5-10 game, and how much? And the dealer just says 200, and so the guy calls with two black, and they just swoop it into the pot. But we don't know if that's 19 chips or 21 chips. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I know this pot might be 4,000, and it's only $10, but it's kind of your job, right? Like, just break that down and then scoop it in. Like, that's literally why they're paying you $9 an hour plus tips, right, to do things like that. So I get it. Like, that one of the reasons I'm embarrassed is that it's unacceptable, I guess. But yeah, it happens. All you can do is generally be right, apologize, and move on.
And I guess I even have in mind more a mistake that would potentially affect the outcome of the hand. I mean, I guess that's a mistake that, like, makes you look bad, and maybe people wonder, like, oh, is there another time when he missed $20,000 and I didn't catch it or something? But, you know, like, if you prematurely show the turn card.
Like a burn-in turn or something?
Yeah.
It seems like that would stick out, so I'm thinking I haven't done that. But I could see how that would be mortifying. Yeah. Yeah, just $400,000 swing or something. Like, yeah, I don't know if you can recover from that, but I guess you would have to. Yeah, I don't recall doing that. And if I can remember the 20,000 one from 4 years ago, I think that losing a pot would stand out.
And does it feel... I mean, so you mentioned, like, that the standards for player behavior are different, which is understandable. Are there other ways in which this is, like, a different experience than dealing at, you know, at Aria, for instance?
Yeah, there's... well, there's imported models who are either bringing cappuccino or fixing drinks or snacks or just being bribed to walk around topless for an hour or whatever. Like, it's so, yeah, that's an entirely different experience. That may have been the $20,000 mistake, may not have been. I don't think so. Yeah, it's a pretty social, chill, just rich guys hanging out, rubbing elbows.
I guess you're not getting pushed too much. Like, it's not like every half hour you're swapping with another dealer.
Yeah, it's funny. Last trip, we just did an hour back and forth, but sometimes the game goes all night, and once it gets to a certain point at 3, 4, 5 in the morning or whatever, we have to decide, is this going to go all night or not? Or is it going to break in an hour or two?
Yeah.
And if we think it's going to go all night, then one of us needs to try to sleep for a while,
right,
and lock the other guy in the box, and, you know, get 3 or 4 hours and then switch and then go till it breaks and then try to sleep till it starts again. Like, that's one of the things you're trading, is the flexibility and just being in this remote location where you don't have necessarily a lot of free time. But yeah, you just have to be ready, like a lack of sleep, whatever it is. But the Bahamas was the longest I've ever dealt, and it was my first trip, and I dealt 10 hours while my friend went home and slept, because we've been dealing so much that he hadn't slept for a day and a half. And by the time you go home and sleep 8 hours and come back or whatever, and I mean, it was, I didn't think beforehand that I would be able to do that, but we made it through. I think I had a 5-minute break in the middle for a Red Bull and a cigarette. One of the players who has dealt in the home game before, like, jumped in and dealt a couple hands. Yeah. So that was, it's...
And that's just like wall-to-wall poker? Like, they're not taking a break for, like, a jet ski or a fancy dinner? Or they're just kind
of... Some of the stuff in the daytime were usually, like, when this last trip in the Ukraine, we were in Odessa, which is on the coast. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a touristy spot for wealthier people in Ukraine and people from other parts of Europe. Like, so yeah, they'd go swimming or go boating or whatever in the daytime, and the game would start late afternoon, early evening, depending on when these guys are ready. You never really know the first couple days, and then you kind of get into a routine. Generally, they're like, playing at 5 tomorrow or whatever, which we love, because then my buddy and I at least know, like, when we have to wake up and get ready and can kind of plan our day. And then one of the bonuses for us, depending on where we're at, like Ibiza or Odessa or whatever, there's generally some nightclub scenes, and sometimes, yeah, like on a Friday or Saturday, these guys will all decide at like midnight that they're going to go to a club, and then the game breaks and we get to like either hang out and get some sleep, depending on how late in the trip it is, or, you know, have a couple drinks and relax or whatever, because we know they're not going to be starting at 10 in the morning, right?
Right.
They're going out partying all night. So they, yeah, those guys do some social stuff. I generally, whether invited or not, decline and take advantage of just like having some chill time and
yeah,
some sleep, or just relaxing and reading or watching TV or whatever. Like, because it really is, like you said, it's wall-to-wall poker for me most of the time. It's just sleeping, trying to squeeze in meals and dealing.
Okay, so from the super high stakes to the decidedly less baller topic, tell me about the three-weekers. I love this concept.
Wow, three-weekers. That's a term a couple friends and I came up with years ago. Two of my good friends, and we were all playing low stakes, and one has moved up higher than I have, and one has since gone back to work full-time. But you just see these guys coming and going, coming through Las Vegas, just bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready to take on the world, because evidently they were crushing their home game wherever they were from and figured Vegas is the spot. I think the two things that are clear that they don't understand is variance, and Las Vegas is not the best poker market in the country.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, like 10 years ago, I understand why someone was like, okay, I'm going to go pro, I'm moving to Las Vegas. But like, that wouldn't even be my top five list now.
No, it would be pretty near the bottom for me if I were basing it just on quality of poker games.
Yeah.
And you weren't trying to play higher than 5-10, yeah, it would be pretty low. And I'm not trying to play, like, I'm not living in Vegas because I need to play 10-20 plus. Like, mm-hmm. I don't play those games. I was just living in Vegas when I switched to full-time. But yeah, so it's some of them make it, but I would imagine the most don't have the track record or a good sense of what their win rate is before they move out. And also, if they're choosing Vegas, that they haven't probably done a lot of research. I mean, the one benefit is cost of living is nice here.
Yeah.
It is cheaper than a lot of the better markets. It's cheaper than LA or DC or Florida or whatever, I would imagine. So, but yeah, so the three-weekers, they just kind of come and go, and we see them, and they're grinding, and they're just ready to take on the world, and they're putting in their hours, and they're talking strategy, and they're bragging about where they came from and how much they're crushing, and we started calling them three-weekers because that's about the line we would set on how long they would last, and we would never see them again. And like, the sad thing is, we just never know. You'll see a guy and see a guy and see a guy, and then you won't, and sometimes we forget, like the absence of someone doesn't necessarily remind you that you haven't seen
especially
them, right?
If you've only been seeing them for 3 weeks.
Or you see them 6 months later. Yeah, exactly. So, but like, one of the things that always, that we're always curious about, or I'm always curious about, is like, what happens? You know, did they move on to better and brighter things? Like, they went to work in Palo Alto. They went to a startup. They're homeless. Like, you don't know what. Maybe they're just playing at Bellagio and I'm never over there, right? Like, I have no idea if they're just out of my little
it's
player
like, pool. I'm not in the 25-50 game at Bellagio.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, so
you're like, oh, that poor wash-up.
Yeah, evidently some of them do move on to crush. But so you never really know what happens, but they, the town and the profession of playing poker for a living in Vegas can just chews up and spits out a lot of people. Like, it's a really, really tough way to make an easy living. Like, it's not an easy gig. And you see guys like playing 1-3 or 2-5, and sometimes they'll last for a couple months and a few months, and sometimes they'll last and they'll move up, and then you'll see them like sitting in 5-10 ripping a bottle of wine and getting a massage, right? Because they've just been running hot for 3 months.
Yeah.
And then like a month later you see them sitting in 2-5, and then you see them not full buying in. And then you don't really see him. And like, I play at Bellagio a few times a year, and I'll see him sitting in like the 500 max 2-5 game over there or whatever. Or you just don't see him again. And I don't know if they moved home or got a job or, mm-hmm. or what, but it's a tough job. As you know, like the player pool gets tougher year after year, and people don't always work on their game enough to get better year after year. But yeah, three-weekers are funny. There really are a lot of people that make it about 3 weeks, and I've seen people move up and move back down, and I've seen people just stick at the 1-3 or the 2-5 and grind it out for 6 months or a year or 2 years, and then I don't see them anymore. But the number of people that I've seen show up in town to play poker for a living from at least a year ago that are still here playing poker full-time for a living is probably less than 1%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's...
Now, I've always suspected, and this is maybe becoming less true, but what I used to tell people a lot was getting good at cards is not really the hard part of being a professional poker player, and not the thing that trips up. Like, I think a lot of people who fail at being a pro, it's not that they're not capable of playing poker well. I've often felt like the bigger problem is money management, not handling downswings well, and also, like you were talking about, not handling upswings well. So thinking, oh, hey, I won, you know, $20,000 last week, now I make you know, $1 million a year. And so I can be getting massages and popping bottles. And does that bear out with your experience?
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty easy to extrapolate and prorate a short time session and just carry that forward into right. like an annual thing. And you're like, well, I've been making a couple thousand a week the last couple of weeks. So yeah, obviously I'm making 100,000 a year at 1.3, and that's probably not the case. Or like, you know, 20,000 a month at 5.10. Those are possible, I guess. But yeah, it's basing your next year's budget on your last month's results is probably not the way to go. Yeah, I think soft skills are pretty important. I would say years ago, those were probably as important or more important than card sense or card technical strategy ability. 10 years ago, because the games were so soft that you didn't have to be good. I think you just had to be not terrible.
Yeah, tight mostly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like just if you're playing a raise pot and a guy has queen 10 and flops a pair and wants to put a stack in, if you can beat that, then yeah, you're just going to print. So I think card sense is more important now, relatively speaking, than it was. But we all know that. Like the games have gotten tougher. Like the bad players just aren't quite as bad, or they've given up. And the mediocre players are a different level of mediocre. Like they're a more well-versed, more seasoned. Even if they're kind of butchering some of the stuff, they're at least aware of a lot more concepts. They're definitely aware of a lot more vocabulary, which frequently scares me when I hear these conversations, but then I see them actually try to execute, and I'm like, okay, they're right. Just as bad as before they learn those words. But, it's like buying books. You know, a lot of people buy a self-help book or a poker book, and most of them don't read it, and the ones who read it, most of them don't apply it or execute it correctly. But so, yeah, soft skills, money management for sure is important. Underestimate your win rate or your income. Overestimate how bad variance can be. Like, just be really conservative. And I know I'm a pretty conservative guy, and I've always made fun of my, like, I'm a life nit and a bankroll nit. Like, I've always been, I had, when we were playing online, like pre-Black Friday, I would keep 100, 200 buy-ins on there. But years ago when I was still struggling in the 1-3 streets, I mean, there were definitely times that I walked into REA with $1,400, and that wasn't my session bankroll, as Tony Angelo would call it. That was my bankroll. Like, there were ways to get other money, but I didn't have any at the time. Like, I wasn't necessarily going back to work, but I probably was. A couple of mini options or whatever, but yeah, the times where my buddy would be in a 2-5 game and be like, Burke, you gotta get in this game, it's amazing. I'm like, I have $1,200. He's like, I'm buying for $500. I'm like, I have $1,200. Like, I understand that I could literally just sit down with $500 and lose at the next hand, and now I'm screwed. Like, conservative. Maybe I'm too conservative. There were times I was forced to not be conservative enough. Most of that was pretty much all post-Black Friday. Like, I bought my house 2 years before Black Friday. And spent about half my roll on that, on the down payment. So there was like $20,000. And then the games were already getting tougher online, so I wasn't building my roll on there. And then Black Friday happens, and most of it was tied up online. I didn't have a lot of cash. Mm-hmm. So I maybe had 20 online, 5 in cash, and then had already put like 25 or 30 in the house. But for me, I'm sitting there with 5,000 in 2011 to play from. So that's where I was kind of stuck at 1-3 for a while. And it's just such a hard limit to pay your bills.
Yeah, if you have to take money out of your bankroll to pay life stuff, it's hard to be growing it.
It's really hard to pay your bills. And then if you're also trying to grow it, it's hard
to get out of one.
It's a real struggle. It really is. Even in Vegas, where the rake was $4 at the time and it's $5 now, like, it's easier here than, you know, a 50 blind max buy-in in California where they're taking $7. Like, I can't imagine trying to get out of like the 1-2 games there or something. But and then the soft skills, like the leaks, there's the pit and there's slot machines and there's strip bars and there's clubs, and luckily
there's strip bars?
Yeah, right. Strip clubs, see, that's how old I am.
Oh, that's a strip bar for a quarter.
Guys, we're gonna pause. We'll be back in a couple of hours depending on how long the money lasts. But like, I'm 51 now, but I was already basically, I was almost 40 when I moved out here, and I enjoyed girls and clubs a lot when I was younger and took advantage of that, but had passed the point of enjoyment. Like, that's, I wasn't a big club scene guy and wasn't out, doing all of that. So before I moved here, people are like, are you worried about like all of those things in Vegas that can get you in trouble? I'm like, no, it's different when you're not on vacation. You're not just, you know, when you're on vacation, it's fine. Blow it on whatever you want to blow it on. When I go to Europe, you know, when I took my wife to Europe last year, we spend money on things we wouldn't spend money on at home. You know, you just kind of splurge a little, right? Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you live here, it's different. And maybe it's just because I'm old enough that it doesn't have the same appeal to me. But also, when you're living in Vegas, those things don't seem as appealing, I think, to most people, just because it's not, you're not on vacation. It's not a special place. You just live here, and the strip is there. I mean, it's still...
It's not a unique opportunity.
Correct. Like, that's exactly what
you don't
have
to go to the strip club on Wednesday night. You can go on Saturday if you want to. Or next Saturday. Or,
knowing it's always there makes it a lot easier to not really ever worry about going. So, I actually feel the same way about playing. It's so much, people ask like how I continue to put volume in or whatever, and it's so much easier to play knowing that I don't have to play, that it's my choice. And if I'm playing 5 days a week and taking 2 days off, great. But like playing those 5 days is easy, knowing I could take 4 days off next week if I want to. I might even decide to, and then get to the second or third day and be like, I kind of have the issue to play poker. It's time to go back to work. So the flexibility is great.
I wonder how much that is also a thing that is throwing off some of like three-weekers or, you know, the people who go pro, even if they are, you know, even if they're accurate about, you know, they've been playing on weekends for 2 years, they've got a decent amount of data, they're fairly confident that they're winning at the stakes they're playing at, they've got a reasonable bankroll to start off with, still, you know, they're not accustomed to playing 40 hours a week and to suddenly walk in and think they're going to do that. I think some people go even harder than that. And or if you're studying on top of playing, you're playing in tougher games now, because when you're just playing on the weekends, you're sort of playing the highest value games that there are. And then if you're trying to add more hours, the hours you're adding are not as valuable as the hours you were already playing. I wonder if it's just sort of like it's a lifestyle that people didn't realize they were signing up for or didn't fully think through the consequences of.
It's a really good point. I think if you're coming from your hometown where the games are softer, you're playing on the weekends where the games are the softest, and now you're coming here. So of course you're going to be playing the weekends for sure. Now you got to find some more hours, but I can't come more from the weekend, right? Like, you've already tapped into that. So that makes sense. And like, you know, the games are tougher. So now your extra hours are coming on a Wednesday afternoon or a Monday night or whatever. It's not quite the same. So you're right. Like, even if you could crystal ball, see that your win rate is X and that that's a sustainable income for you, like that's a comfortable living. Playing 15 hours a week for pleasure and profit is different than playing 40 hours a week for profit. The pleasure can still be there. It's not guaranteed, and for me it fluctuates. I was really, really happy up until a few months ago about really not experiencing any burnout, and I've kind of felt a little the last few months, but it's a different subject. But yeah, so for these guys, a lot of them come out and they're so eager that they're, like you said, playing more than 40. They might be playing 50, 60, 70 hours a week. A, they don't have anybody out here.
Right.
Like, they don't have any distractions. And if they are like legitimately serious about it, they're focused. So they're actually welcoming that opportunity to not have all these family and friend distractions and just grinding their faces off with or without studying. That can kind of burn you out too, especially if you're spinning your wheels and not getting the results you're used to. You have a little bad variance at first. Like a lot of the guys that you've talked to over the years that, Gelfond or Durr or whatever, the ones who are upfront about it readily admit that they probably ran above EV to the start, which is why they stuck around. That's not why they're doing well now, but it's why they had a chance to stick around and be smart and study and do well. Because a lot of guys who run really bad at first just don't enjoy the game and quit, right? So these guys are probably running a little above average, or even the ones who aren't, you know, who have an accurate sense of their win rate. It's you can certainly wear yourself out, or you go the other way and you're playing 40 or 50 hours a week, and like you said, you're not used to that, right? So now you're a few weeks in and you are burned out. Like it's a strenuous game to be, if you're doing it well and paying attention and thinking and analyzing and doing all of these things, which I'd like to think I do in my A game, and I know I don't do the majority of my hours, but if you're playing your best and you're decent at the game and know the things that you should be thinking about, it's straining. I mean, if you've played 12-hour tournament days where you're pretty wiped out afterwards, right? Like, I've heard from some pretty smart guys who will actually take some low attention orbits and just kind of give themselves an orbit off.
Yeah.
Knowingly to play ABC to just kind of, it's not necessarily like mindfulness, but it's kind of a reset or recharge. So yeah, these guys probably aren't doing that, and they're probably paying more attention at first, right, and just wearing themselves out. Yeah, that could be a case, cause of burnout. Or they decide, like, I've worked really hard the first few weeks, I'm gonna take some time off, and they do want to go to the clubs, and then they realize that the clubs is more fun, and and they have a good week, and they torch that, and they figure, well, I'll make another $4,000 next week, and then they don't, and now they don't have $4,000. And yeah, it's I don't know, it's tough. There's the soft skills are important, the discipline is important. Having a realistic set of expectations is probably important, but I don't know how you do that beforehand. It's pretty tough to really get a sense of what it's like.
Hey everybody, Andrew here. Sorry for the interruption, but my conversation with Burke got interrupted at this point anyway, so I figured this would be a good time to break in and tell you that well, first off, time is just really tight during the World Series of Poker, so I don't have a strategy segment for you this week, but of course there is plenty of juicy, juicy strategy available for you at tournamentpokeredge.com. That includes dozens of videos from me, hundreds of videos from other instructors, many of whom have been guests or hosts on this show. You can get that for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com. Many of you know and have already purchased, which I appreciate, that I have a book called Play Optimal Poker now available. It is an accessible, practical introduction to game theory. For those of you who are maybe a little intimidated by game theory, I try to hold your hand and walk you through the most important concepts from game theory and how to apply those, even in games where I think people tend to assume that they don't apply. So if you're someone who says, oh, I play small stakes games, or I play with players who aren't very good, so I don't need to know anything about game theory, I believe that game theory can be useful to you, and I think that this book will be useful to you. It's called Play Optimal Poker. It's available in Kindle or paperback from Amazon. It is also available in a variety of ebook formats from knitcast.com. Finally, there's going to be a Knitcast meetup on Saturday, July 6th at the Gold Coast Bowling Alley from 10 a.m. to noon. The Gold Coast is the casino right next to the Rio, right across the street from the Rio. If you're on the casino floor, you can just kind of look for escalators going up or look for signs for the bowling alley. It takes up much of the second floor of that building, so not too hard to find, and it's usually not too crowded at 10 a.m. on a Saturday, so I don't think we'll be hard to find there. We'll be there from 10 a.m. to noon. You can meet me, probably Carla, some other former guests and listeners of the show. I'll have copies of Play Optimal Poker available for purchase if you want to buy them on the spot, and I would also be thrilled to sign your copy of Play Optimal Poker, whether you already have it or are purchasing one at that moment. Most importantly, I would be thrilled if you come. Hope to see you there.
So how do you deal with those things? Like, what's the schedule that you put together for yourself to keep from falling into those traps, to keep your sanity?
You know, it's interesting. When I started out, I was part-time working in card rooms and then full-time within a year or so. But I was a player before I got hired. They actually knew me as a player. I'd been playing there 6 months or a year or whatever in this little tiny stakes in card room in Le Center outside of Portland. But we touched on that last episode. So I'd always played, and even when I was full-time, I was playing some. I would play, if I was working 4 or 5 days a week, I would play one or two nights, or maybe one night in the card room for several hours and play a little, mess around online. I had my first online account on Paradise in 2000, so yeah, I'm officially 100. And then Seattle, same thing. I would play about one day a week and play online, you know, a few hours on a day off and a little bit after work sometimes. And then moving to Vegas. So that's when I moved down here and I was part-time at Bellagio. I was working maybe 3 months a year and I was playing the other 9 months online and live. So that was a transition to not full-time, but most time, I guess, right? Like say 3/4 time, to where I felt like it's basically like a full-time player, but you get some breaks, like month-long breaks throughout the year, 3 or 4 times.
And you've got an easy fallback, too. Like, exactly. You know, worst-case scenario, you're not going to be out on the street. You have...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I could, like, accept one of those offers from the guys at Bellagio to work full-time, right, and not just work the tournaments. And the 3 months, like those tournaments paid probably half my expenses for the year. So it took a big cushion, like off the monthly nut or whatever, like having half of it taken care of and then 9 months to take care of the rest was fine. But that got me into kind of used to having a routine. And then Aria, I would generally just deal a couple hours and play afterwards. I'm maybe dealing 10 hours a week and playing 30, but I was playing basically five nights a week as soon as I got out from dealing, which we talked about. So used to playing on a fairly regular schedule. Like for most of 6 years, I was playing most of the year five times a week and got used to that, even if it wasn't 8 hours a day. And then when I quit in 2013 and went to actually playing full-time, pretty easy transition. I've always, the last several years, I basically always work swing shift. So I'd start at 7 p.m. and then move that to 5 p.m. So kind of start in the evening, 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. was roughly what my schedule was. And so when I quit, I would generally start at 3 to 6 p.m. and play roughly 8 hours and go home at midnight or 2 a.m., just depending. And that was already a fairly well-established habit, so that wasn't hard. I don't have a lot of external pressures, so a lot of things pulling me away from it. It's pretty easy to keep in that routine. So I like playing nights. I don't really enjoy the day games as much. I don't enjoy graveyard. I don't like driving home when it's light out already.
Yeah.
That whole, I've got blackout curtains, but it really messes up your circadian rhythm if you're like out in daylight trying to go to sleep afterwards. Yeah. It's fine if it gets light afterwards.
And you're married, like you like to see her from time
to time. Right. Yeah. So graveyard's rough, day's not great. Swing shift, I was used to working. Swing shift seemed natural for players. So that transition was really easy. I basically kept the same schedule. I play weekends. I always worked weekends. So I was used to that. The games are better, tips are better. As a player, the games are better, whatever. So generally, for several years, I've either been out taking Mondays and Tuesdays off or Tuesdays and Wednesdays off, depending on what my wife's schedule was at the time, to make sure we had at least a day off together. But yeah, I don't know if it's, I don't think it's difficult because that's what I planned and that's what I preferred. I mean, just through my preferences, that was a natural schedule. So it's a pretty easy schedule to keep when that's what you want to be doing.
And how do you work in studying? I mean, that, it sounds like those are your playing hours. When are you on BioSolver?
Right. I generally study on my days off. And also, I've got a couple study groups that we're on a hiatus right now for the summer because everyone's busy. But typically, once or twice a week, we will do an hour or two call. And sometimes that falls on my day off, and sometimes I just get up early and do that before I go play. So we haven't done that for a while, but self-study on days off, basically. If I do have a thing, if I don't put in a full session for some reason, if I am not really feeling it 5 or 6 hours in, if I don't play like at least 8 hours and I go home quote unquote early, those are good nights for me to maybe spend an hour working on something.
That's the time you've already set aside.
Exactly. I would already be busy with poker. I'm not missing anything and might not be in the mood to play, but I can be in the mood to get better. So I probably 5 hours a week, if I had to guess. I typically on my commute, I listen to strategy podcasts like Thinking Poker on the way in or Just Hands or guys talking about. Ideally, what I'll do is I'll listen to yours on the way home. And when we get to the strategy part, I'll pause it and I'll listen to strategy on the way in just so I kind of get the wheels spinning.
I like that.
In the right direction. And then on the way home, I'm listening to entertainment or interviews or audiobooks or whatever that aren't strategy related, but things that are either just interesting to me or that make me better.
I'm curious how structured are those strategy calls? I was a part of a group like this a real long time ago, and it kind of fell apart because it was just sort of like eight people who were all kind of like, I don't know, what do you want to talk about today?
That's how it started, and it actually got more and more structured. We actually got on a fixed schedule, and I kind of glossed over that. When I say we're on hiatus, we haven't been doing it the last few months because of that. Like, it gets really fractured, and the more and more busy people get or whatnot, it's hard to keep it together. And also some of the arrangements that were happening staking wise in the past aren't currently happening. So the people that were staking, that were putting the group together, and the people who were getting staked, that were motivated to be on these calls for their benefit and the benefit of the stakee or staker, that's not happening. So basically the group isn't really there. So I've got another group of four or five guys, and we're basically just kind of in a Slack hand history group for now, which means you can kind of come and go as you please and do it on your own time, which is nice, and talk about hands. But that's about the extent of the group work that I'm doing right now, to be honest. So, yeah, it's really tough to keep them together.
Yeah. And these are all Las Vegas-based pros?
Mostly.
Is that, I mean, I guess in some sense they're your competition then, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I wish I would have talked to these guys beforehand so I could mention, but like there were, and now that I've already mentioned the word staking, I definitely don't want to mention their names for people to guess if they were staking or being staked. But yeah, luckily there were tournament people, there were PLO people, there were hold'em people, which A is cool, so you're not necessarily, it's not necessarily people that I was playing with all that often. I would say one or two of them I would come across fairly regularly in my games and my stakes, and the others are playing higher or playing tournaments or playing in a different market. I mean, there are a couple of guys from California, there's one in DC. So not so much that, but also because of that, that's one of the reasons it's so difficult to keep it together, because not everyone has the same interests,
yeah,
or skill sets or same thing they're trying to learn, right? So it's pretty fractured. It was a really interesting and entertaining and intelligent group, like people that I would love to hang out with and talk poker and or have a beer or a cup of tea. But as a strategy group, it worked decently well for about a year and then kind of just wasn't.
How much of a community is there among the Las Vegas pros? I mean, it's like in Maryland, like most of the pros know each other, but it's a way smaller number of people.
It's a great question. I actually forgot. That's what I was going to say, was that even the guys that I do run across, like from this group, so we're friends, we've talked strategy, and now they're sitting across the table from you or sitting next to you at the same table. I have several friends like that, and the thing that I like the best and respect the most of those who get to know each other well enough and have an affinity for each other and have been around long enough, there's a spoken and unspoken edict of play your best and we're still friends afterwards. Mm-hmm. Because back in the day, I would sit with somebody that I was friends with and we hadn't played together, and I'm like, so are we like trying to stay out of each other's way? Like, we're 100% not colluding, but are we trying to avoid each other and just like kind of whatever? And like, no, man, just play your best game. And I'm like, cool, that's a really good policy to have moving forward. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing is just knowing that one of you beats the other one out of a pot, that's poker player versus poker player. And then most of us have been doing it long enough that the variance is pretty trivial at this point. You can laugh about it then, but if not, you can still laugh about it later. And it doesn't affect your friendship. Like, I rarely am in a game where I don't have at least one person at the table that I'm good enough friends or acquaintances with that I have their number and we chat occasionally. Not at the table about strategy, but like we're good enough friends that like we know each other away from poker as well. And it's it used to be a little bit awkward. It used to be more awkward for me when I was playing higher than I was comfortable,
right?
Where the stakes were, yeah, more meaningful, because it's harder to swallow the variance at that point. And you don't want to stack your buddy, and you definitely don't want to be stacked by your buddy, right? But when you've been doing it longer and have thousands of hours in there and are rolled or staked appropriately to where buy-ins aren't really, it's just, if you're both decently good, it's mostly just unavoidable setups of one version or another. Yeah. And most of us understand that's mostly going to balance out. And then I've got friends that I know are just better than me, so I know it's actually not going to balance out. They're going to get slightly the best of it over the long run. And then I may or may not make an internal decision to actually kind of avoid the close spots with them because they're just better. So,
right. Maybe, and that's not from a collusion mindset.
Correct.
That's from self-interested. Like,
I'll do the same thing
with a good player.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I'll do the absolute same thing against a better player that I don't know or like. And that just seems like common sense. I'll try to be in position. I'll try to have better hands. Like that.
Right. That's seems, just playing well.
Yeah, seems like it. I mean, and then all my days off try and get better. Right? maybe have the situation come up less often in the future.
Now, I had a tricky spot yesterday, actually, in the Millionaire Maker. I ended up sitting out of 5,000 people or whatever played yesterday. I'm sitting on the immediate left of a woman that I've coached. And someone, I actually hadn't seen her in about 2 years, but I used to work with her. I'd met her a few times in person. I liked her a lot. We were very friendly. She's a very sweet woman. And I think it's like extra tricky where there was the coaching relationship in particular, because I also have some insight into roughly her bankroll situation and like how big of a deal this tournament may or may not be to her, and just like various things like that. And then I got into a spot where I had an opportunity to bluff her in a really large pot. And I did, and I sort of felt guilty about it. You know, I didn't show it to her, but if she had asked what I had, I would have. Or I was kind of debating. I was like, would it be nicer to just lie to her and tell her I had it, or what? So she didn't ask, so I just didn't say anything. And then eventually she bed-beat me to eliminate me from the tournament, and she's all apologetic. And I was like, oh, don't worry, I've left you in that.
Perfect. Yeah, it's. It's certainly uncomfortable, and it can be difficult, and it can put you in those dicey spots where at least, like, even if the tricky decision is afterwards, should I tell her the truth or not if she asks if I bluffed, right? Like, it can certainly be awkward, but I guess that's just kind of how life works and kind of how poker works. But it's there are times that I wish that were not what was happening. Like there were times I wish I was just playing with 8 strangers. I mean, ideally, they're all terrible at poker, but it's those days have long gone.
Have you had situations where people, did actively want to collude with you in some? I mean, not necessarily like, let's tell each other our whole cards, but who are sort of like, hey, if I open a pot, like, I'm serious about it. Don't 3-bet me. I mean, have you had people try to push you into those tricky spots?
Definitely not the first thing that you said probably wouldn't happen. Like, there's no signaling or marking or whatever. Like, none of that. Straight up collusion, like, obviously. But the other, I would say, some minor version of that occasionally, and to be honest, more of it at the lower stakes.
Yeah.
There were like bad nitty local regs, say like especially 1-3, and as you guys know, like I spent years in the 1-3 streets, and a lot of these like 2 to 6 day a week, maybe break even, like older guys or whatever, but that you become friendly with or not, but they would just be like, give you the elbow, and you're like, I mean, when I re-raise you there that I have it, like, just get out, right? And they're like, I'm like, okay, but like, basically, yes, but I already know that. Like, that's, I've seen you play. Like, we played together. Yeah, I'm familiar.
That's not really a signal. That's just you're being bad at poker.
Exactly. I'm familiar with how Old Man Coffee plays. Thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and continue to do that. But yeah, please don't give or ask for any insights into like strategic things. But for the most part, no. And like you said, like at the lower stakes, more at 1-3, less at 2-5, and significantly less at 5-10. There's kind of a bad reg camaraderie that's, they're not there to make money, they're there to not lose money.
Right.
And I think it probably more often unspoken than spoken, implicit than explicit, that, yeah, like, stay out of my way and I'm going to stay out of your way. But that's, to me, I kind of equate that with like a satellite or a super satellite where, ideally, don't say the words out loud, but it's fine if you know that I know that we should probably be folding here. I would hope it's as above board as that, but I don't have a lot of experience with it, because mostly the kind of guys that would be bringing something up, like if it were an offer or information, they're generally the guys that I'm ignoring or needling to begin with. They're right, not really my cup of tea, so. I didn't really run across. I would just like take that opportunity to reshower them, I guess, for bringing it up.
But, right.
Yeah, obviously you have Kings Plus, but sometimes I don't, so do what you want to do.
the sense that the movie Rounders gave very much was sort of, it's the pros versus the tourists, and those are the two teams, and obviously that's very outdated for what the world. I mean, do you feel that? Like, do you see tourists in like a kind of they're the other side?
No, but I get it the other way. I wish it was as outdated as it feels, because one of my biggest pet peeves or annoyances is the perception from tourists that A, if you play for a living at the table and someone else at the table plays for a living at the table, clearly you're partners. And just, if I sit down, like, I always have a tough decision of sitting down and being quiet and keeping to myself and watching the game and not socializing, or socializing, being chatting, being friendly, and making it the social friendly game that a lot of people want it to be. One is better for my concentration, the other is better for the vibe. But my problem is, sometimes there are rec players or tourists that have interesting things to say and we'll have a conversation. Sometimes there aren't. But if I sit at a table and have an actual friend at the table and we have things in common, whether it's the game or the Golden Knights or whatever it is,
that's playing right into their fear.
Yeah. So now we start chatting and we're yucking it up and we're laughing. And now, like, Mike walks by and we're like, hey, look, there's Mike. Like, I heard he won a bunch yesterday. Or, hey, there's Tim. He, you know, lost a tournament yesterday or whatever. Yeah, now it looks like we're comrades in arms and we're just friends. But since we're sitting at a table that's competitive, I think they associate that as there must be some kind of thing going on. And it's unfortunate. And there's not, no matter how loud you yell, I'm not cheating, it doesn't make people think you're not cheating, or any version of that. Like, that doesn't make it less likely. And so I try to dispel that, and I really can't. And the other thing that comes up a lot that's hard for me to dispel, that doesn't make a lot of sense, is people who sit, they think locals, if they're like, are you a local? When they're in Las Vegas, they're visiting Vegas, and they sit down, and they're like, oh, you're local? And I'm like, well, I live here now, but I grew up in Portland and Seattle. But yes, I do live in Las Vegas. Oh, okay. And well, who else is a local here? Like, are you a local? Are you a local? And now they just think these three players who are locals are the players to watch out for. Mm-hmm. And you don't get better at poker when you move to Vegas. And when you switch your driver's license to Nevada, there's not a poker quiz. Like, living here doesn't make it. Some of the worst players I know live in Vegas, right? And some of the best players I know don't live in Vegas.
Yeah.
There's no correlation there whatsoever. It's just that of the majority of the poker professionals they play with while they're visiting Las Vegas, most of the people that play for a living and most of the excellent players will happen to live in Vegas, because that's where the fucking game is, right? And if you're playing in Boston, most of them will live in Boston. So yes, most of the pros live here. That doesn't mean that the people who live here are good. And it's kind of like communicating clearly. When you start to shift to that, they don't really shift with you, and they're not understanding. So they're not really trying. They're not listening all that well when I explain, like, Nevada driver's license doesn't make you good at poker. And they kind of laugh, but in their head, they still are scared of the people who live here and not scared of the people who are visiting. Mm-hmm. And they have that us against them feeling, even though it's me against the other eight players, and more ideally, me as a good player against any one of the bad players at the table. I don't really care where they're from. Plenty of them are from Vegas, but it kind of sucks, because it enhances the predatory feel of the game.
Yeah.
And it, to them, it feels like a them versus us situation. And yeah, that perception is out there, and I don't know a good way to dispel it. And it's uncomfortable for me, and it's scary for them. And I really wish there was a way to, like, fix that, but I don't know what that would be.
I think to some degree, like, that strikes me as partly a kind of like preemptive ego defense thing on their part.
Sure.
Because, you know, they're probably not favorites in the game,
sure,
which means, like, there's a decent chance they're going to lose. And then if they can attribute that to, oh, I win in my home games, but then when I go to Las Vegas, I lose, it must be because all those Las Vegas pros are colluding with each other.
Right.
Like, they have incentive to tell themselves that, regardless of what any evidence.
Yeah, that seems fair. I mean, it's pretty consistent with what the stories that most people tell themselves,
yeah,
that are, whether they're good or bad at poker. And it's just like a lot of people blame the dealer or the card or variance or whatever, but it's the version of when I win, it's because I played well, and when I lose, it's because I'm unlucky. Well, I mean, both of those kind of balance themselves out over time, but
yeah,
it's probably just a different version of that. Yeah, it's just a protection, like, story they're telling themselves, but it's unfortunate. But whatever it is, that I'd prefer the bad luck version, because it doesn't feel like there's any cheating involved. They're just like, man, I'm just snake bitten. I'm the unluckiest person in the world. But I'm going to keep trying, right? Like, because I want them to keep showing up. But the other one actually makes them more hesitant to play. Mm-hmm. And it just, it has an entirely, being unlucky feels a lot different than being cheated. And I've never knowingly been cheated, but it'd be pretty horrifying.
It's shitty to even have to worry about it.
Yeah, like that would, I don't play a lot of private games, right? I don't play any private games, but one of the big concerns is that, is like, if you win, do you get to keep the money?
Right.
And do you get to win, right? Like, those are real concerns for anybody who's been around for a while, and it sucks to be playing in a casino for these people who are playing for fun and playing in a five diamond casino and still have those concerns even though they're unfounded. And yeah, I wish there was a better way to dispel that, because it's kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. So as a person who's eligible to play the seniors tournaments, how unique does that make you among the Las Vegas pros? Like, are there other 50 plus?
There aren't many. Wow, seniors. It's so funny. It's come up more a lot in the last year or so, A, because I turned 50 right before last series, like late May, and B, the couple months beforehand, I was just like, guys, I'm playing the seniors, and everyone laughing. I'm like, no, I'm seriously playing it. I qualify this year. I've been waiting for 4 years or whatever. So
it's, I mean, I'm saying, actually, you've got a goatee, a chain, a backwards cap. Like, you don't present as 50.
Well, or just trying to deceive myself. Like, could just do that. Like, refusing to grow up doesn't make you not old. The pros and the cons. The pros is the field is great. The cons is that I'm 50, which means I'm closer to being 100, which I would rather be getting closer to 20 again. It's the player pool. No, not a lot of pros. I used to say that pre-Black Friday, I was, to my knowledge, the only 40-year-old plus person that was like 16 tabling 100 NL plus profitably. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know anybody still of the people that I run into that were mass tabling like cash games back then for a profit. But that's just because I was older when I started, right? It has nothing to do with being particularly skilled at 40 or 50. It just happens to do with starting at like 30, I mm-hmm. guess. And kind of getting on the internet wagon a little bit early, like in 2000, even if it was 2-4 limit or whatever. But in the pool, not a lot of 50-year-old plus guys. The Wizards from back in the day are getting to be in their late 20s, early 30s. Like, I'll see Seaver and Benba and Bonomo, and they used to be kids, and now they're just like young adults. I'm friends with Ben. Like, he's good people. It's funny to see him like evolve from his first final table like 9 years ago or whatever. And yeah, there's not a lot of older professionals at any, like, there's a decent amount of retired break-even players probably, mm-hmm. but mostly 1-3 and some 2-5 that just kind of get by being tight, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, it's a hobby that pays for itself.
Yeah, and we often wonder, like, if we could see their graph or their actual paper notebooks, whatever they keep their stats in. Like, are they losing $4 an hour? Is he winning $6 an hour? We'll just call him break even. Like, but other than that, like, not a lot of 50-year-old plus guys. Yeah, it's kind of a dying breed. And also, it's kind of a dying breed. Like, that's one of my fears, actually, is keeping up skill-wise. Like, I don't think I'm deteriorating yet mentally, but I do forget more things than I used to. I need reading glasses now. My hearing's never been great, but it's not getting better. Like, I actually have these things that like old people have, or I'm at least inching that direction. So I, like, one of my nightmares is like being Johnny Moss his last couple of years, where he's just the spot, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he would just donate when he was in his 80s. People would show up and just flee some of his last small fortune or whatever. But I worry about my skills diminishing, and I worry about the player pool continuing to get better and the games getting tougher, and wondering where that intersection is. Like, I don't know if I have another 5 good years left, 15 or 20 good years left, or maybe I'm playing 5-10, 10-20 the next 5 years and it's back to 5-10, and maybe in my 60s I'm just playing 2-5 and hopefully for a profit. But that's, yeah, it's hard to stay above the curve. The games have gotten so tough now that it takes more work than the majority of people think to even stay even. Mm. If you say took a 2-5 player that was winning $40 an hour 5 years ago or 10 years ago, like that guy's worked his ass off if he's still making that. But mostly he's probably not worked his ass off and he's not making that. There's some regs in like the 2-5 games that we wonder how they're still doing, and we're like, oh, his wife's got a good job. And so maybe he's just not losing any money when he comes in, but I don't think he's making the $81,000 a year that he claimed last year, right? Yeah. To his coaching students. not crushing guys. Not going to do a name shout out this time. But
that was just a specific number. He knows who he is.
Let's just call him the coach. May or may not be a woke. But yeah, so like, keeping up with that, like your skills diminish and the games are getting tougher. It takes a lot of work, I think, to maintain, let alone. And it's for me to move up in the stakes and improve my win rate has taken a lot of work the last couple, 3 years. Hopefully I can maintain that effort. Hopefully that'll maintain the results. But it's really hard. I'm not sure. Does that answer your question?
It does. I forget where we were going. Yeah. And I heard you call in to the Aria just before we started recording, so I know you're on a 5-10 list. So you've been moving up in the world.
Yeah, it's let's see, last we spoke was last spring. I was still staked. I was playing 2-5 and 5-10, but more 2-5. And I think I would say the last year or so, it's probably 40% of my hours are at 5-10. And I'm currently on my own for everything below. I'm staked for 5-10 plus, mm-hmm. and on my own for 2-5. Say everything below 5-10, but it's the only game I play below 5-10. So, happily haven't sat in a 1-3 game for probably 3 years. But yeah, I'm shooting for, I'd like to play at least half my hours at 5-10 plus. Mm-hmm. I actually have some hurdles to that mentally. Like I game select pretty aggressively, and I've been far more choosy than I needed to be, and far more choosy than I or my coach or my staker wants me to be. Like Andrew would be happy if I just played 40 hours a week at 5-10, mm-hmm. and just sat in whatever lineup was there, and still thinks we would beat it at a decent clip. But it's just hard for me. Like it still feels bigger and the players still feel tougher. So I just need more and more hours to get more comfortable there. But I'm sitting in it more and getting more comfortable, and I'm beating that game for less, slightly more than double than I'm beating 2-5-4 with maybe 900 hours at 5-10. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a big sample size, but
by the time you shot profits, you're not making that much more than 2-5, right? Yeah.
Right. So it's, but the upside's there, and it's a way to get better, mm-hmm. and it's a way to get used to playing against tougher players. And if you're not just going to be playing red chip games all the time, you kind of have to jump in. So, but yeah, it's going better. I'm making more at both games now, and I'm playing bigger than I was slightly relatively than before, but it's a good life.
That's impressive. Like you said, I know it takes a lot of work to keep one's, not just to keep one's head above water, but to be moving upwards. And I appreciate you taking the time to step by here and talk to me before you run out. And I'll let you run out unless there's anything else you wanted to leave us with.
No, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to visit anytime. I truly, truly enjoy hanging out and chatting with you, with or without a microphone.
Yeah, and this is one of the highlights of WSOP for me, is getting to do some of these in person. You know, like so often we do this over Skype.
And, for sure.
It's way more fun to do in person. So yeah. I'm, thank you.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, Andrew. Rain, tapping on my window. Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you.